Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, welcome to Yin Radio. Our show today is called See Jane Run, Take Two. It's a combination of pieces from earlier Yin Radio shows, plus one brand new and timely installment. See Jane Run, Take Two is about running. Running in the Olympics, running for office, being a leader. We'll start the show with a woman who's working to get women running for office and ultimately get a woman in the White House as president. Marie Wilson is president and founder of the White House Project, which is headquartered in New York. Keeping with that theme of Madam President, we go next to political wonder women and a review of women who ran for the highest elected position in the U.S. Then we'll hear from another kind of runner, Olympian Angela White. She's getting ready to compete in the 100-meter hurdles at the Olympics. And we wrap up the show with Rebecca Miles, who broke a glass ceiling when she was elected chair of the Nez Perce tribe. Much to do, little time. Let's start with the White House Project. Marie C. Wilson is the president and founder of the White House Project. It's an organization she formed in 1998 because she recognized the need to build a truly representative democracy, one where women lead alongside men in all spheres. It's the aim of the White House Project to get more women in leadership positions in the country, and ultimately into the White House itself. Marie Wilson has been an advocate of women's issues for more than 30 years. Before she took the helm at the White House Project, she was, for almost two decades, the president of the Ms. Foundation for Women. She's the founder of Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day, and the author of Closing the Leadership Gap, Why Women Can and Must Help Run the World. Born and raised in Georgia, Wilson has five children and four grandchildren, and she lives in New York City. She travels the country speaking about women's leadership. I spoke with Marie Wilson by phone in 2006 and originally aired that interview in November 2006. Here's Marie C. Wilson talking with me by phone. Marie Wilson, thank you for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be out in the other part of the country today. It's a heavy-duty Halloween here in New York.
We are going light here.
Oh, good.
You started the White House Project in 1998 to help build, as your bio says, a truly representative democracy in which women lead alongside men in all spheres. But men have led for so long. Why would you say it's important to have women involved? So in other words, what was the impetus for starting the White House Project?
Well, the impetus for starting the White House Project 8 years ago was that we saw that women's leadership was stuck. At that time, I was at the Ms. Foundation for Women, where I'd been almost 20 years. And it was really clear that women were not moving into the ranks of leadership. But the second, and I mean in every sector, but the second thing that we saw that was interesting was what law professor Stanford Deborah Rohde calls the no-problem problem, which is most Americans can't believe that women aren't in leadership. They have no idea that now we're 67th in the world in women's political representation, or that we only have 15% of Congress when we ask countries like Iraq and Afghanistan to have 25%, that we have, you know, only 10 CEOs at the top of the Fortune 500 and one at the top of the Fortune 100. They just have no idea that we're not moving into leadership. So the White House Project tackled it by choosing the name of the job that nobody could argue we had been in, the White House. And that was our reason.
Now, that kind of might explain a little bit about why you kind of organize your programs around three different areas of getting the pipeline and, you know, your three steps, so to speak.
Yeah. We organize around three areas that we think are really important in order for women to lead in any sector. One is, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And therefore, we have to actually show women as leaders and change the perception of women as leaders, because the social cultural ideal of women has never changed. It's still wife and mother. It's not a public sector ideal. So we like to work at making sure women are on television shows, that they're portrayed as leaders on film and documentary. We award those shows and documentaries and advertising campaigns that show in fiction what can't be seen in fact. And we also have something called SheSource, an online database of female experts that we use to allow more women to be on shows. We do the pipeline, which we call the pipeline to leadership, because we have to put women for the next 10 years into a long-term pipeline, including the state legislatures of America that have been stuck at the same level for 10 years, and get them moving up the pipeline if we want to have women at the top. And finally, if we want women, we have to give them non-traditional platforms. They have to be seen as experts on national security, on the economy, in order to lead in any of these spheres. And so we work to make sure that women have the expertise in those areas, and the women that have it are seen as authorities.
So perception, pipeline, and
platform.
Okay, very good. That's cohesive and works for me. I can get my head around that real well.
Oh, good.
And Vote, Run, Lead, now that's a major program of the White House project,
right?
Pretty much in the pipeline project, the pipeline end of it, to get women running for office?
Absolutely. We feel that women have to be much more involved and comfortable in this very, what has been a traditionally male area, and that women leading alongside men in this area is probably extraordinarily important, because it will give men more freedom to bring more of themselves to the table. Therefore, we know that numbers matter, because if you don't have numbers of women, the first women are always asked to be man enough for the job, and are covered by the press. Is much more about their gender, their hair, hemlines, and husbands, we call our research, are than their agenda. So we, in different regions of the country, train about 100 women at a time or more to run for office and to debate, to communicate, and all the skills that it takes to be a part of leadership in public policy and in politics. We don't ask them to commit to running that year, and that's the difference in our program and most programs. We tell them, if you think you want to run in the next 10 years, come see us. And then we get them in there, and we teach them and persuade them and inspire them, and then they want to lead next year.
Okay, so these are formal training programs?
Yes.
And you've done these around the country for?
For 2 years now, so we've trained close to 800 or 900 women to run for office.
Have you started to see any results yet? Are women from these programs?
We have 50 women out of our 400. We have 50 women running right now, currently, and that's a pretty good percentage. We have 18 that are running in the state of Colorado or in the West, and then in Minnesota and Washington and Georgia, we have probably about 10 or 15 apiece that are starting to run, and we have some that are already have already gained public office since we first started, who are already in city councils or school boards or in the state legislature. As a matter of fact, we expect the first Latina who's ever been in the state legislature of Minnesota to be one of our alums this year.
Excellent. Let's move back a little bit to the whys of it and the changes that we're interested in. It could be argued, and I know it is argued still, that there's no reason women need to be involved. Men are doing a fine job, and you can say they are or they aren't.
Now, wait a minute. You're not going to go there this
I'm not,
time, are you?
I'm going to give you something to shoot at. Why? I mean, we've got a skeptic there. I have talked to women here in Moscow, and I'm sure around the country, that wouldn't vote for a woman for president. They think it's a man's job, and they don't think that women need to be in those leadership roles. How do you address those kinds of arguments? What changes are seen when women are leaders? And
let's just start that in almost any area that you would ask women normally, if you had a problem, for instance, that dealt with your child, I have five children. Mm-hmm. If you had a problem with one of your children, would you ignore any resource in the whole city or the state? Or, I mean, women will go anywhere to get their children taken care of. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you go and use all your resources to help that child's life if you had a child that had a problem? If you had a husband who had a problem, or a brother or mother, wouldn't you use every resource? Well, I think that there's no doubt we have a country that's having several problems, and we are not using half our resources, and that is the resources that women bring. And when women bring at the when women are at the tables of power, the research tells us that they think outside the box because they've had to even get there, and we need people who think outside the box. That they are more apt to actually bring people affected by the policy they're dealing with to the table. And I think that's important. If we talk about even Iran or what's happening in North Korea, not having sat down with people who we don't agree with has not put us in a better place or a safer place. And women know that. If there's a problem in your neighborhood, you can't ignore it. It's your problem. And we have a problem in our world. And women are more apt also to work more collaboratively, and men are quite pleased. We've done all this research, or not we, the research institutions have, that show that women are more likely to actually be collaborative in these settings and to get more work done. And the men in general seem pretty happy when there are more women at the table, because as they say, hey, we could go home tonight. And they call on me, that's the other thing. Oh, they actually call on you. But I think men are happy when women are at these tables because, again, it allows them more freedom to be who they are, to bring up issues that are important.
Understood. So you talk a lot about style, but you also touched on issues. So it sounds like those are some of the base changes that we are looking to see, that you are looking to see, and that are being seen when women are more involved. Both style, right, and in substance.
Substance and style. Yeah, there's style and substance that women bring. But again, I don't think it's because of any kind of, you know, bread in the bone genetics. I think I go with what Ron Heifetz of Harvard said in a book called Leadership Without Easy Answers, where he talked about leading from the foot of the table. Most women have had to be strong leaders from the foot of the table. They haven't had authority placed in them, and so they've had to bring people together to have authority. They've had to build communities of trust to have authority, and therefore they're more apt to have to employ a leadership style that actually works better for the situation that we're in this very complicated global society.
Let's just wrap up a little bit and tell me, I'm going to be running, first of all, I'm going to let you know we're going to run your White House Project PSAs on this show.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, we're very glad that you have them available for us.
Thank you.
What message would you want to give women, maybe even especially young women, as we all head to the polls this upcoming Tuesday?
Well, the first thing I'd say is just our message of the White House Project to women across Idaho would be vote, run, and lead. And that is vote and actually make sure you take a number of people with you. Call your friends. Make sure that people know every election is important. People here died so you could do this, and people in other countries have died every day to make sure they had a democratic government they could vote in. So, you know, ours doesn't take much. Vote. Actually, I'd like you to think about whether you've ever thought about holding a public office. Once you vote, think, am I somebody that would like to be on a commission or a board or run for office? If not, do I know some woman who might? Because women are more apt to run if a neighbor calls and puts the idea in their mind so that they can say, hey, Jen called me the other day, instead of, I was thinking, which is a harder thing to say. So think of either yourself or somebody and invite them to run for office at some time. And lead. You can take on leadership from any place. You can write your paper if you think something's not being covered fairly for women. You can call into a show like a show on this on this station. You can have a voice. Use your voice. And finally, there was a this is not about gender. I want to remind you, this is a really about transformation, about bringing all our resources to the table to transform our communities for all of us. And So it's not just about women. It's about women for the sake of having more people at the table to give us a good society.
Great. I appreciate that reminder.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marie Wilson, and best wishes for your good work.
Thank you so much for actually doing our running our PSA.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay. Good to talk to you.
Marie C. Wilson is the president and founder of the White House Project, a project aimed at getting more women involved in leadership positions in the U.S. at all levels, and ultimately in the White House itself. She spoke with me by phone in November of 2006.
Real security for our communities, our nation, and our world requires a new kind of leadership, women and men who realize that we can't solve the world's problems alone. If you care about real security, now is the time to make your voice heard with your vote. On November 7th, vote. Go to voterunlead.org and get involved. Go vote, go run, go lead, go girl. This message was brought to you by the White House Project, a national organization devoted to women's leadership.
You're listening to Yin Radio Show. It's called See Jane Run, Take Two. This story comes via intensive web research. Some of it is from Rutgers University. Some of it is from the U.S. Senate pages. Some from web collections that other interested parties have maintained. It's certainly not comprehensive, and it may include some inaccuracies. It is, however, quite inclusive. It's a surprisingly long list of women who ran for the office of the U.S. presidency. It's called Political Wonder Women. Women have been running for president of the United States for more than 100 years. Yes, that's right. Hillary's not the first. When it comes to U.S. presidential leaders, many other women have logged firsts, starting with Victoria Woodhull. She ran for president in 1872 on the Equal Rights Party ticket. Yes, that's 1872. She lost to a fellow Ohioan, Ulysses S. Grant. 12 years later, Belva Lockwood ran for president in 1884 and again in 1888. From then on, the late 1800s until 1960, only one other woman was proposed as presidential candidate, and that was Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman for president ran across the front of a 1943 Marvel comic book. But it also said in the small print that this was Wonder Woman 1,000 years in the future. But it wasn't until the 1960s that the presidential attempts by women picked up. After a number of women served in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate in state legislatures, as governors and as mayors. 1960, Whitney H. Slocum ran for president under the Greenback Party. Then in 1964, Margaret Chase Smith ran. She was a Republican, member of the House of Representatives from 1940 to 49, and senator from 49 to 1973. But in 64, she was presidential candidate in the primary elections. In 1968, Charlene Mitchell. But then in 1972, things really picked up for women with four, count them, four female presidential candidates. Patsy Takamoto Mink, Bella Savitsky Abzug, Bella Abzug, Linda Osteen Jenness, and the renowned Shirley Anita St. Hill Chisholm. Shirley Chisholm was the first female black member of the House of Representatives, and she served 14 years from 1968 through 82. She was a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination at the Democratic Party convention. Here she is at the convention.
I will not camouflage or support the forces that wish this country to become an undemocratic influence in the community of the world of nations. Here at home, I will tell the truth about the poverty and hardships suffered by so many of our citizens, not just the minority or jobless group traditionally thought of as poor and deprived, but the working poor as well, the millions of men and women who work hard and constantly, but still cannot make enough to decently clothe, house, and feed themselves and their families. I will tell the truth about the visible differences of race and sex that have been used to isolate women of all racial groups and minority men as an unpaid or underpaid source of labor, whether they are working in factories or fields, in their own kitchens or other people's kitchens, in office buildings or in government agencies and on college campuses. I will tell the truth about the big corporations, the defense industries, the utilities, the railroads, the airlines, and the agribusiness powers that are the true welfare recipients. The taxpayer spends far more for these corporate subsidies than she or he does for the so-called welfare recipient, the individual who simply cannot get the training or opportunity necessary to support themselves and their families.
Now, after Shirley Chisholm ran, more female candidates continued to seek the U.S. presidency. 1976, Margaret Wright and Ellen McCormick. Ellen McCormick, by the way, was the first woman to receive matching funds. She appeared on the ballot in 18 states and received a total of 267,590 votes in the primaries and 22 votes from delegates at the Democratic National Convention. And she engaged in a debate with President Jimmy Carter. In 1980, Ellen McCormick ran again and was joined in the race by Deirdre Griswold and Maureen Smith. In 1984, even more, Sonia Johnson with running mate Emma Wong Marr. And Isabel Masters, who didn't give up, she ran again in 1992, 96, 2000, and 2004. Gabrielle Holmes with running mate Gloria E. La Rivera. And in 1984, also Patricia Scott Schroeder. Congresswoman Pat Schroeder was Democratic candidate for the nomination in the primary elections, but she did withdraw from the race before the party convention. The first Democratic woman to actually appear on the ballot paper was Geraldine Ferraro, who was vice presidential candidate in 1984 as Walter Mondale's running mate. They lost to Ronald Reagan, but the fervor over her candidacy was great. Here's Geraldine Ferraro at the Democratic convention.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro. Proclaim tonight, America is the land where dreams can come true for all of us. As I stand before the American people and think of the honor this great convention has bestowed upon me, I recall the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who made America stronger by making America more free. He said, "Occasionally in life, there are moments which cannot be completely explained by words. Their meaning can only be articulated by the inaudible language of the heart. Tonight is such a moment for me. My heart is filled with pride. My fellow citizens, I proudly accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States. Thank you.
Geraldine Ferraro and Pat Schroeder generated excitement. Serious women candidates. Yet after the fervor and the losses, things slowed down for women seeking that highest office. The ranks of senator, congresswoman, governors, and state representatives and mayors were growing, however, slow and steady. And this probably fed the growth that was seen among presidential female candidates three elections later. In 1988, we only had two, Willa Canoyer and Leonora Fulani, who ran again in 1992 with running mate Elizabeth Munoz. Also in 1992, Gloria LaRivera, Susan Block, Helen Betty Halliard, and Millie Howard. Now, Howard ran again in 96, 2000, and 2004 as an independent. In 96, we had candidates Mary Cal Hollis, Susan Duncan, Ann Jennings, Joan Farr, Mary Frances LaTulle, Georgina Dorshuk, Elvina Hoy Duffy, Monica Moorhead, with vice presidential running mate Gloria LaRivera. Moorhead ran again in 2000, as did 96 candidate Heather Ann Harder. Still in 1996, Diane Beal Templin, who ran in 2004 as well. Marcia Fineland, with Katie McClatchy as running mate. 1996 set records for women candidates. I counted 11, if I got it right. In the year 2000, Elizabeth Hanford Dole led the women candidates, all 12 of them. She had served as assistant to the president for public liaison, secretary of transportation, and secretary of labor. Her husband, former Senator Bob Dole, was the Republican presidential candidate in 96. 4 years later, Elizabeth Dole ran, but she did withdraw from the Republican convention because of lack of funding. In 2002, she was elected senator for North Carolina. Also in the running in 2000, among some 200 candidates who had registered for presidential elections in one or more states, were Kathy Gordon Brown with VP running mate Sabrina R. Allen, Temperance Alicia Lance Council, Paula E. Bennett, Deborah Katz Puschel, Angel Joy Rocker, Dorian Yeager, Rachel One Family Miller, Raj Allison Officewala, Gloria Dawn Strickland, Linda D. Blodgett, Sandra S. Duffy, Johanna Joan Malone, a candidate in the Republican primary from the District of Columbia. Johanna Joan Malone ran again in 2004, along with a large group of female candidates. Another large group of female candidates. And that group of 2004 was Mildred Williams Glover, Janine Shabib, Georgia Howe, Melanie Pridgen, Diana Ramsey Rasmussen Kennedy IV, Deborah Elaine Allen, Joy Elena Graham Pendergast, Jackie Hayward, Deborah Joyce Renderos, Nancy Warwick, and a name you might recognize, Carol Moseley Braun, the first African-American woman to serve in the U.S. Senate, and former ambassador to New Zealand, a country which, by the way, has a female prime minister currently, the Right Honorable Helen Clark. Here's a portion of Carol Moseley Braun's stump speech from August 2003. It sounds like something that could be used today.
We've gone since 9/11 in a situation in which some folks have figured out that if they pander to our fear, they can push an extreme right-wing agenda, not only here, but abroad. What was supposed to have been a war on terrorism turned into a misadventure, just running out, you know, in Iraq, doing whatever. I mean, we still, think about it. When was the last time you heard Bin Laden's name? Think of who? Ben who? Ben missing. Our young men and women put in harm's way for no real rational reason. And now, and even though the aircraft carrier and the war is supposed to be over, we're still hearing horrible reports coming back. All those people, you know, remember old Europe? And the people we thumbed our noses at? Now we're saying, well, maybe we do need you all's help after all. Well, you know, this is no way to interface and interact with the rest of the world. At a time when the challenges facing us are global in nature, we can't solve SARS and AIDS and poverty and globalization going it by ourselves, tell them to bring it on. We've got to work well with others. Yeah. We've got to work with the rest of the world and the leadership of the rest of the world to raise up those values that have that made this the greatest country and that make us proud to be Americans. 2004 will be a time for us to make a decision. What path will we go down? Will we continue to let the fear mongers and the hate mongers and the people who divide and who pick fights dominate our politics and direct our direction into the next century? Or will we choose to embrace that which is best about this country, build community, and engage with the rest of the world in behalf of a future that we'll be proud to have left in our time? That's the issue. And that is why I've stepped forward to run for President of the United States. This is a very serious candidacy and a very serious campaign. As you've heard from the introduction, I am as credentialed as any of the fellas and more than most.
Each year, there are fewer and fewer first steps available thanks to these women. Each woman to run stands on the shoulders of her predecessors and gets higher and higher each time. And each one breaks new boundaries. Each one is a Wonder Woman.
Installment number 3. Angela White has been running a long time. As a kid, she did all kinds of sports and competed in track and field events of all kinds. But it is in the 100-meter hurdles that she excels, even though she says she's not a typical sprinter.
I don't think I match the sprinter mentality. I'm more of a, like, I like the events where you have a chance to just dig down deep and go for it on that, you know, the last sprint. And that can even happen in the 400, 200, but in the 100 and the 100 hurdles, there's not really that opportunity.
But she is good enough to get into the Olympics, twice now. Angela White is the assistant track coach for the University of Idaho, where she has put her studies on hold for Olympic training. From now until she heads to Beijing, she'll be training in Singapore.
Just in time for monsoon season. Mm-hmm. Hip hip hooray for that. So we'll be down there to kind of acclimatize to the time difference, perhaps some weather. I don't know if it's going to be the same as Beijing. And then different event groups will head up to Beijing in time for their events.
Now, as a second-time Olympian, Angela knows the drill. She'll move into the Olympic Village 6 days before her event. Plenty of time to get used to the weather, the venue, village life, and village food.
If anything, you want to get sick that first couple of days. Like, if you're going to have some sort of gastrointestinal issue, you want it to go in that first couple of days. You want to get it out of your system so you're ready to go. And that actually did happen to me in Greece, 2004. I got food poisoning or something a couple days out of my event, and luckily I was fine.
Even with food poisoning, she placed sixth in those Olympics. Pretty good for a hurdler with a distance runner's mentality who is sick a few days before the prelims. Angela White got into the hurdles a bit indirectly, and that might explain her non-sprinter mentality. The route she had taken was by running fast and jumping.
Once we got to junior high, you know, organized sports started in school, and I did volleyball, basketball, and then track would start, and I did everything. I ran, I threw, I jumped, but I really liked the long jump. But unfortunately, I have a little bit of a congenital knee problem, and my dad, we didn't know at the time. We just thought it was like a bad knee, I was doing something wrong, we didn't know. So at the time, my dad's like, you know, we sh- probably shouldn't jump on that knee. It's going to do some damage to it, or you know, it's going to cause you pain. So you're fast. You like to jump. Why don't you run and jump at the same time?
So she did. She ran and jumped and ran and jumped. But it didn't start out quite so well.
Not good at all. I took like 20,000 steps in between each hurdle and just tried to run as fast as I could and with no form and, you know, probably within an inch of my life. But it ended up working out for some reason.
Then Angela found the rhythm. It takes grace, defined by precise steps and fluid motion, to do hurdling. Hurdling has a very specific and calculated rhythm.
All athletes will take 8 steps to the first hurdle and 3 in between. Generally speaking, 8 to the first, 3 in between, and then you have your run in, however many steps that is. So there's definitely a rhythm to it, more than any other kind of event in track and field.
Practice is the main part of being a track and field competitor. Competition takes seconds. Practice takes years. So you have to love the rush and be able to deal with the anxiety and get past the pain of practice. Angela introduced me to the concept of being track drunk.
The equivalent of being drunk, but induced through exercise or induced through running a track workout. So, for instance, for me, it's like running 3 300s pretty hard with good recovery, but still pretty hard. And then when you're done, your head's spinning, you don't talk properly, your stomach hurts, you think you may throw up, and some people do throw up. It's like being drunk / hungover, but it could be fun because everybody's feeling sick, and so it's kind of funny. Yeah, it's not as fun as being drunk per se, but it's a lot healthier. But yeah, I think after a really good workout, that's one of the things. It's when you're going in, you're like, I hate track. I don't know why I'm doing this. You know, like I'm quitting right now. But once you get through that workout, and especially if you've done a good job, and you know you have, and you've hit your times or maybe exceeded those times. And after that feeling goes away, you know, if the physical, you know, burden of the workout, you feel good about yourself. You feel like you've accomplished something and you're moving in the right direction.
Practice pushes the body, but competition is completely different. It's all in the mind.
It's more of a mental thing once you get to a competition, because the reality is, once you go to a competition, especially major competitions, such as the Olympics, all the work has been done, hopefully. All the hard work has been done. All you have to do is rely on your preparation, be confident in your preparation. But a lot of times, your mind can take you out of that completely, and you start doing things you've never done before. So for competitions, it's more of a, like, it's a mind workout rather than a body workout.
So for Angela, the pressure will be on. Angela will be training for a few more days in Singapore, then heading to Beijing and the Olympic Village, and to practice some more, but not on the main track.
You don't step foot onto that track until your first event. Yeah, security reasons. So there's going to be practice facilities for us. And then outside of the stadium or adjacent to, we'll have a warm-up facility. The day of the competition, we'll go there, warm up, and then head into the track.
Angela will be at the track in advance, however. She has sort of a ritual, a need to go, to be there before the race. It seems like it's related to getting your head in the right place.
And I personally like to go to the track because there's this, it's almost like there's a spirit in there, you know what I mean? And it's amazing, and I'm in love with track stadiums. There's something about track stadiums that, I don't know, especially over in Europe, and any big venue, it's just amazing to be in a track stadium and to hear the people and, like, to watch. Luckily, I'm not on the first day, so I get an opportunity to see other people compete and see how the crowd is reacting, and that's just one of the things that that's become a little bit of a tradition with me, is to go into the stadium and check that out first.
Since it's all mental on race day, it's best to start with your head in the right place. Then there's the competitive mind games that athletes play with each other.
There's some people who will talk mess and try to get into your head and play that game, right? And then there's others who just want to see how it's going to unfold. I'm kind of the person who wants to see how it's going to unfold. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm very competitive, and I do have a certain expectation that I'll run a certain time or faster. I think the thing is that I'm not sleeping on anybody, because there's so many phenomenal hurdlers in the world, and there's always an up-and-coming hurdler from somewhere else. So for me to be like, well, you know, I'm going to go out and definitely make the final, that would be very ignorant of me to say. I can't really focus on the outcome. I just have to focus on everything, like, in the race, so the start, the hurdles in between, everything, until the finish line, and then see how it unfolds.
But there are reasons, beyond just her style of focusing on each step of the race, that she's cautious in setting goals. She had knee surgery earlier this year, in March, and it took a little longer to recover than she had hoped and expected. Expectations for her performance dropped as recovery took longer and longer. But she's in a good place, and she qualified. Despite the knee surgery and an unwillingness to talk herself up, Angela White will be someone to watch.
For those who are watching, just know that I'm Canadian, so if anything, probably not much coverage of me, unless you get Canadian, if you get CBC, but if I'm in a race where there's an American, then you will see me, and I'll probably be dancing behind the American so you guys can get more airtime and perhaps bug some of the Americans a little bit, just to rile them up a little bit.
Good. So. You got to try to play a few head games. You know, that's
I got to do something, and I'm not going to talk mess to someone. That's not really mine, so if I kind of like act like an idiot, that's kind of the way I do it, and then they're like, who the heck is this chick? And I'm like, but we'll see. We'll see if that works, if my Jedi mind tricks work. They probably won't, but I could always try.
Angela White runs for Canada in the Beijing Olympics in the 100-meter hurdles this month. The preliminaries are August 17th, semifinals on the 18th, and finals, where we hope she'll be running for the gold, are on the 19th. Up next, installment number 4, Miles Through a Glass Ceiling. This segment was compiled from Rebecca Miles' talk at the 2007 Women's Leadership Conference at the University of Idaho. I call it Miles Through a Glass Ceiling because she, Rebecca Miles, did go through a glass ceiling. Rebecca Miles was the first woman elected to the highest position of leadership at the Nez Perce tribe, that of chairman of the Tribal Executive Committee. It is the top position in the tribe. The year was 2005, and Chairman Miles was only 32 years old. Now, tribal government is a lot different from U.S. governments. She was elected first when she was 27 as the Nez Perce Tribe General Council Chairman, and she was re-elected 4 times. Then she was elected to the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee in May 2004. And it's the members of the Executive Committee who elected her as chair. But she first got on that committee at a time of conflict for the tribe. Here's her description.
It just so happened the United States and the state of Idaho and the tribe released the terms to a potential settlement. It was the largest agreement the tribe would make since they made treaties with the United States in the 1800s. And they released it 7 days after I was elected. And so, you know, to our people, making agreements with the United States is a difficult thing because we're still waiting for some of these other things to be honored. When the meeting started, we immediately put our non-Indian office of legal counsel in front of our people, our elders, my mother, for crying out loud, and had them explain to us how our water rights were going to be settled. And that just didn't go well. It just was a nightmare. And I remember I probably was only on council a month, and I mean, people were yelling at us and so forth. And I thought this was just was a nightmare.
Rebecca studied the topic, though, as she delved into it. She expected to reject the settlement, but in the end, advocated for it. And in the end, the tribe did accept the settlement. But to this day, there's disagreement about what should have been done. And that conflict shaped Rebecca's personal experience in tribal government.
My personal experience in that, you know, was surprising. My entire leadership experience that I'm talking about today, and I hope is a benefit to you, was shaped around these 9 months. Because where I got a lot of opposition, and including the 2 years that I served as chair, was surprisingly not from the group that I thought I would get. The challenges that I got were from women.
She was the only woman on the council at the time. She was young. It was an emotional topic, and it got personal.
So at that time, I thought, okay, then this is not for me. I had many phone calls. I had a few phone calls that were, you would consider them, you know, a life threat. And so I thought, this is not for me. And my father used to wake up and pray for me because he knew it was just sitting on my shoulders. And so I was going to resign. And about a week or so, we had another annual meeting, and our chair was not reelected.
Now, before we go on with the story, it's worth noting that tribal leadership is not historically a woman's role among the Nez Perce, any more than it's a role women have filled in the U.S. But men's and women's roles were distinct and respected, but women were not chiefs.
Women traditionally did not carry those roles, but those roles were definitely different. And they were for a reason, and they were honored roles. Women's roles were very much honored, where we live in a society today where we're talking about equity. We have women's conferences where we're pushing those things. And back in our time, our women would have, I think of what would they be talking about pre-contact? They wouldn't be in a position to have to have their role honored. So we live in a different society definitely today. So I definitely, in that time, would not ever hold the position that I was honored to have.
Nonetheless, it did happen, and she was elected in the blink of an eye. And Rebecca was hoisted through a glass ceiling to a position she had not previously considered.
The 9 of us choose the chair, and, you know, it just happened really fast. A motion and a second was made, and that's the way it happened. And I think, looking back now, and it wasn't very long ago, but I think I would have really thought harder about that position, because there's nothing glorifying in being the first woman. There is not. They talk about breaking the glass ceiling, and let's say you just imagine going through the glass ceiling. Well, you're taking some cuts along the way, I guarantee you.
She rode a lot of waves. She didn't fit in, felt ostracized. She felt over-critiqued, not unlike the critiques we see bandied about in the press about national-level women politicians.
You know, not fitting in, you know, not being, you know, I didn't just gel with the rest of the administration, and I didn't, you know, I just kind of felt like, you know, the only woman, or, you know, the only whatever. And it just, you know, I don't get invited to things, and I don't, you know, just felt out of place all the time. And she looked at me and she said, "Rebecca, be very afraid if you ever do fit in." And I always felt so strong about that. That advice has helped me being the only woman on council, which is not a fun thing. And then to be a young single woman is even harder. And I think being single at my age was very difficult for a lot of women in my tribe to deal with. The choice to be single, the kind of values I believe I was raised with. And I was thinking the other day of how they were criticizing Hillary Clinton. She had a real pretty shirt on under her suit jacket, but it was just too low. And I've noticed a lot of that criticism was coming from women.
And what would happen if she, God forbid, got emotional? Or if she cried?
Our chair before, he's a good friend of mine, he would get emotional. A man get emotional, tearful. That was never viewed as being weak. If I would get emotional, and when I would get emotional over the settlement, to the thought of what has happened to our people and the time. And so when I would get emotional, especially from women, it was just a sign of weakness.
Doesn't that sound like the old double standard? Sure it does. And Rebecca just works with it.
It definitely is a double standard, and that's the other thing about women's leadership. There is a part where you have to accept the reality. There is a different standard. There is. And if I would have went in and fought that, I would have been recalled by now. But I've accepted that in order to leverage and be an effective leader, to choose to live a disciplined life.
Disciplined? Like conservative, like reducing the targets for people to shoot at, like dating.
I have never dated on council because I'm so afraid of what people will think.
So watch your words, your actions, your clothing. And you feel like you don't fit in, and just how do you do this? Well, Rebecca sought support. Rather than bemoaning that support wasn't offered, she sought it out and she found it. And that led to courage. And over time, confidence.
And I always talk to our people. I talk to elders. I don't make it public, but I'll go talk to elders, and a lot of elderly men are mentors to me. And it fills the void of losing my grandfather over 10 years ago. And so it's nice to have that wisdom. I think for the most part, when you have that support and you get advice like, don't ever fit in. Don't choose not to ever fit in. That's a good place to be. Mm-hmm. That all of a sudden you then start to develop courage. Mm-hmm. And there were times where it really took the courage to talk in front of your own people about a touchy subject, and you have a line of people, angry tribal members that are ready to chew you out, or going to represent your people in the Capitol. They're all of a sudden, when you imagine the magnitude of doing that kind of work, courage would really kick in for me. It would have to kick in, and then confidence developed over time that it was okay, that it's okay to be afraid, it's okay to cry. I always was an emotional person, but yet a very strong person.
Rebecca learned, is still learning no doubt, as young as she is, to accept herself as she is, a leader, and emotional, confident, woman. She says that if we want to have doors open to leadership roles, and she believes we need to be in those roles, then we all have to support the whole woman.
When we fight for these roles and we fight for equality, to know that that comes with everything. There's except for, there is no exception. It comes with supporting the entire role. But I challenge all of you to support women.
It's strange to me that one woman has to beg or challenge women to support each other. I thought that's what we do well. We are the supporters, especially of each other. But we're also the maintainers of social life and social structure. We teach the children, at home and in school, how to be good kids and to be good, successful adults. We show them their roles and we praise them for staying within the proper bounds. It's hard to encourage them to step outside the bounds that we've seen all our lives and that we've lived with all our lives, even if we wish we could step outside those very same bounds. Maybe it's just our need to maintain the status quo, not to have too many things change in our lifetime. It's comfortable to know where we belong, and that men will be presidents and women will be mothers, and kids will rebel. And it's hard to cheer for our contemporaries who achieve greater heights than we do ourselves. But history does show that once that glass ceiling is broken, many of us will follow. Raise one woman up to break the glass so that anyone can get through. Perhaps we should just get past it all and have some courage and support women as leaders.
Miles Through a Glass Ceiling was recorded at the Athena Women's Leadership Conference on the University of Idaho campus in October of 2007. Music background is La Metamorfos del Vampiro by Caminos del Sonido. We end today's show with music from Plurgid, and it features Catherine, Bolte, and Emily. It's called, appropriately, Glass Ceiling. Joining me on Yin Radio today for our show, CJ and Run, Take 2. You can contact Yin Radio at YIN Radio, that's Yin Radio at vpfound.org, that's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org, or give a call 208-882-1626. For today's show, I'd like to thank Marie Wilson of the White House Project, all the political wonder women who've run for the presidency of the United States, Angela White, and Rebecca Miles. I am your producer and host, Sandy Billings, from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. This is Yin Radio. Until next week.
Weaponless wedding, birds are lying low, the past never fade away. Flush ears are drooping, many verb ends, hide me.